Good evening. It's Perry Hoffman again. I want to welcome you to our ninth call out of our 10 calls for our fall series. We're very fortunate and lucky to have Dr. Frank Yeomans with us tonight. It's an honor and a pleasure for me because Frank is not only a longtime colleague, I won't even say how long, Frank, but we go way back working together before most of these treatments were even manualized, and so it's just a pleasure to have Frank join us. I also do want to let people know that the success of this series was such high demand that we'll have a second series starting in the first week of January, January 8th, and we already have our speakers mostly lined up, including Dr. Yeomans, who will be coming back and talking on narcissism, but we also have Charlie Swenson coming back, Lois Choi Kane, who will be talking about mentalization with families, Brian Palmer, who will be outlining a CME course that's now going to be available for psychiatrists on borderline personality disorder, Alec Miller. So lots of exciting things, John Gunderson, lots of wonderful topics and people who will be joining us. But for tonight, it's just my pleasure again to introduce Dr. Yeomans, and I'm going to have Dr. Yeomans introduce himself and a little of his background so you get to know him firsthand from that. Frank?
Okay, well, thank you, Perry. It actually is quite heartwarming to think how far back we go and all that's happened in the meantime, and mostly good things. It's good to see the developments in this area, and certainly you deserve a lot of credit for NEA, BPD, and all the dissemination of information you do. I'll just start by saying, officially at this point, I'm a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the Weill Cornell Medical Center, and also an adjunct associate professor at the Columbia Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. And just parenthetically, that last affiliation might be a little bit surprising, because a lot of people in the field of specializing in BPD think that psychoanalysis is very outmoded, but I would like to put in a plug for at least certain people within the psychoanalytic community working very hard to keep sort of a cutting edge of what's going on and try to add to the whole mix of what we can offer to people who are suffering from BPD. So I'll try to go into some of that during my talk. Just in terms of my own involvement, when I started my psychiatric residency in 1981, for whatever reason, I had a kind of affinity for the patients with BPD, and as you all probably too well know, a lot of people in the field of mental health have a stigma that's attached to the diagnosis, and so I was considered a little bit of a rarity among the residents, not the only one, but I don't think it was the majority. And for me, the whole problem of borderline personality disorder has always had a special interest because, to me, it has something to do with some core issues about what it is to be a person and deal with emotions in an intense way. And we might talk about that a little bit more in the course of the discussion, but as a resident, I became associated with Otto Kernberg, who's one of the main developers of the whole understanding of borderline personality in the 70s. He wrote a number of books and articles and was one of the early proponents within the psychoanalytic community of doing research, which is extremely important, as most people would agree, I'm sure. And I'll just refer to the title of one of his early books, which is called Internal World and External Reality, because that's really kind of, in a nutshell, part of the way we see the problem, that people have an internal world that's populated by images that don't correspond fully well to the world outside, and getting the internal world and the external reality to match up better is part of the problem or part of the challenge. Certainly, we would be the first to agree that there's a constitutional, biological difficulty in people with borderline personality disorder. We all know about the studies with the amygdala lighting up and so on. And in our way of trying to understand and approach the problem, we put a lot of emphasis on the emotional intensity. But I think what we add to the picture that may be less stressed in other models is an emphasis on how, well, some other models, there's a whole range, as you know, is an emphasis on how the individual reads sort of the interaction between self and others, how one reads the intentions and just the presence of others in their life and in interaction. So having said that, let me take a step back and go to the first slide after the title slide describing transference-focused psychotherapy, or TFP. When we talk about a psychotherapy, first we have to think about what is it designed to help with, what are the indications, and with TFP we're talking about something that targets borderline personality disorder and other severe personality disorders. We have a concept of borderline personality organization that goes somewhat beyond the more narrow DSM description of borderline personality disorder. And in the concept of borderline personality organization, the three main, well, I think that's the following slide. Let me see. Well, yeah, let me get to that a little bit later. So in any case, the indications include first treating severe personality disorders, including borderline. What's our frame of reference according to which we conceptualize our understanding of the disorder? It's something called psychodynamic object relations theory, which I'll give a 5 or 10 minute overview of in a minute. I want to pause for just a second on the term psychodynamic because it's kind of a misunderstood term these days, or perhaps not misunderstood, just not understood. It's, for all intents and purposes, almost a synonym with the term psychoanalytic. They overlap a great deal. But I just want to refer people to what the term actually means. Psychodynamic means the mind in motion. And this model of understanding people in general, as well as patients, is that all of our minds have different forces that are constantly in motion and can bump into one another and cause conflict. In fact, the idea is that everyone's mind has conflict, and the way to adapt to the world is to come up with the best compromise solutions you can to these conflicts. So you've got forces that are pushing you in many different ways. You've got loving emotions, you've got angry emotions, you've got hating emotions, you've got prohibitions telling you not to act on your emotions. You've got external reality that's telling you what to do and what not to do. You've got the presence of other people. So in the mix of all these forces that may be in conflict, how do you as an individual decide to satisfy urges without getting into trouble so you can feel good about yourself without depriving yourself of too much satisfaction of basic needs? It's a complex mix. That's what makes psychotherapy, you know, a long and sometimes complicated process. So moving on to what changes and how. In this model, in the complex picture of what is borderline personality disorder, the fundamental concept here is that it's a disorder of sense of self and other. It's a disorder of how one feels about oneself. It's a disorder of identity, if you will, that there's a fragmentation in the sense of identity as opposed to a coherence or completeness. And we try to go from this fragmented sense of self to a coherent sense of self through reflection on the experience of self and other in the here and now, which becomes in the therapeutic setting with us. So the practical arrangements for this treatment are that we meet twice a week in an individual therapy, and we set up the frame, that is the conditions of treatment, through discussion of the treatment contract with the prospective patient. And it's possible to have additional treatments if there's a specific problem. There might be a family treatment, there might be a couples treatment, there might be substance abuse treatment, what have you. Also, in describing a therapy in general, you talk about the therapist's stance. And here I'm going to introduce a term which is sometimes a little controversial because it's the term of being neutral or neutrality. But I don't want to give the impression that it's that terrible indifference that one can find in some of the stereotyped analytic images one has where the analyst just sits and says, uh-huh, a a few times during the session, and that's it. We are people who are very interested in our patients and certainly not indifferent to them and interested in their well-being. Neutrality here means that rather than get caught up in one or the other side of a patient's conflict, you try to help reflect the conflict back to the patient so he or she can work on resolving it themselves rather than have you take part of that task and thus not help the person grow in their ability to work on their own dilemmas. Simple example, a patient of mine who came, began treatment after having left college four times. And one of her goals at the beginning of treatment was to complete college. So as we set up the treatment with a discussion of methods and goals, one of the goals was she'd get back to taking some courses as she was working full-time, so it was part-time school. A few months into the treatment, she was talking about dropping out of school, which was her pattern, unfortunately. And I was sort of saying, well, you know, I'm not sure that's a good idea. And the patient said, I'm sick and tired of you always trying to push me into getting a college degree. Here is the problem. She was trying to get me to take the side of a conflict within her. She both wanted to have the degree, but then started suffering when she was in college. So it would have been easier to see me as carrying one side of that dilemma. So I simply said, look, you know, it's not my life. It's really up to you if you do or don't stay in college. But the reason I'm talking about it is at the beginning, you seem to find that an important goal. I kind of reminded her about the conflict within instead of seeing it as me or her parents or somebody else in her life just wanting that for her. And as we worked on this conflict, it turned out that her problem wasn't performance in college. She could do fine, actually. Her problem was that her own internal standards were so demanding that she never did well enough to feel good about herself. And it was that internal pressure that made her want to leave, not the external reality. Anyway, I hope that gives you a simple example of neutrality. And finally, the treatment technique more generally, we set a safe frame, or sometimes called a safe haven, where patients can experience intense emotions without too much anxiety about something bad happening. And this increases awareness of intense affects, and it attempts to get people to be more consciously aware of affects that they tend to not grasp so much symbolically through language, but rather act out in a way that sort of discharges the affect without having mastery over it within the person. So, moving on, to simplify this a bit, our focus is on helping people who might have difficulty reading self and others. I've gone over this. The sense of self is fragmented, distorted, and often superficial. Similarly, the sense of others is not so complex. It tends to be perhaps superficial and fragmented and shifting from one impression to another without much continuity. So this leads to a lack of continuity in experience, and often that horrible emptiness that a lot of my patients say is part of perhaps the worst part of their experience, that awful sense of being empty inside, which usually I don't believe is the bottom line case, being empty. I think it's more rather that when you can't kind of get a handle on your intense affects, they can be dissociated and you're left feeling empty. In any case, the whole picture can lead to a cycle of a temperamental disposition where because of emotional regulation and distortions in the way you perceive others, you can actually create the very problems you anticipate even if they weren't there to begin with. And the therapist's job is to help intervene there. So going to the next slide, we're looking for change in terms of what we call identity consolidation, helping somebody be more coherent and whole in their sense of who they are. We try to help them develop more adaptive defenses. I'll talk about defenses more in a minute when we talk about object relations. But every individual on the face of the earth uses psychological defenses. They're ways of managing stress, anxiety, internal conflict, and some people tend to use ones that are more adaptive and some tend to use defenses that are less adaptive. So we try to get people going from the less adaptive to the more so. With these changes, we find that people tend to have a modulation in the intensity of their emotions. They can sort of, you know, get a better handle on them, and this leads to better adaptation to the challenges of life and work, living a fuller life with more continuity, more investment in both some activities and the people in your life and that fuller sense of things. In addition, of course, to a decrease in the more specific symptoms, whether they be self-destructive actions, suicidality, or perhaps substance abuse or an eating disorder, promiscuity, what have you. So let me now, going on to the next slide, give you a little bit of the theoretical underpinning. And here we're talking about a particular model of the mind and how it's built up. It's called object relations theory.
And Frank, I'm...
Oh, Perry? I lost you, Perry. I don't know if I'm still on. Are we there, Perry? If you're not hearing me, Perry, send me an email. I'll be checking my email as I'm listening to you. But since I don't want the hour to go by in silence, I'll continue to talk unless I hear from you, okay? In any case, having taken a little pause to introduce...
Frank, this is Jim Hall. I just tuned in on our channel, and I hear you fine, and I'm thinking maybe Perry just had an electronic malfunction, so I would urge you to go right ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm back on. I got knocked off for some reason. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. Well, like I said, it gave me a little breather. Thanks, Jim. So
sure.
But were you going to say something, Perry? It sounded like
just wanted to say that anyone who had a question should just send it to neabpd@aol.com.
Okay. Good.
Thank you.
So here we are trying to get an idea of how the mind might work and how it's built. This is called object relations theory because it has to do with the self and others. Others sometimes referred to as the object. That sounds a little impersonal, but it actually has to do with the development of psychoanalysis, where Freud talked a lot about loving drives, you know, affiliative drives, affectionate drives, and angry, negative, aggressive drives. So somebody after Freud, Melanie Klein, said, look, people don't just experience drives. They don't just love. They love someone or something, and they hate someone or something. So she started talking about the object of the drive, hence object relations. So this particular theory is built up around the idea that in early development, the infant experiences intense moments. Some of them are extremely gratifying, at which time it's like the person exists in heaven. The soothing, nurturing, feeding presence is there. Everything in the world seems right. At other moments, as is inevitable in every infant's development, they're hungry or in pain, and the help isn't there immediately. Since they don't have a sense of continuity over time, those moments are experienced with anxiety, terror, fear. And in the first instances of the soothing and nurturing being there, the other is experienced as all good and a sort of a perfect provider. In the latter, where there isn't the response to the negative state, the other is experienced as at best neglectful and perhaps even sadistic or wishing harm. So the idea here, if you go on to the next slide, is that these internalized relationship patterns modified by fantasies within the mind, we don't say that these are accurate internal representations of what actually happened. These things begin to accumulate in an individual's mind as basic representations of self in relation to other. So what happens is, this dyad, the relationship between self and other, exists within the individual and has its basic impact on how the individual feels about the self, because the individual internalizes the whole relationship. A person can be good and soothing to self or harsh and punitive to self. However, these relationships are also externalized, so they determine to some extent how the individual experiences self in relation to others in the world, whether or not those others actually fit the bill. And two classic dyads are, in borderline personality, are the abuser-victim dyad or the abandoner-abandonee dyad. What I've left out here is that there can also be the dyad of the perfectly loved and cared for individual and the perfect provider. So in this theory, if we go to the next slide, dyads of similar affective charges tend to sort out into two groups in an early stage of development. Everything is seen as all good or all bad. So in this situation, if your mind is organized this way, something good happens and the whole world is great. Something bad happens and everything is horrible. It's that all or nothing, black or white thinking that we tend to see. Now, in the course of successful psychological development, if you move on to the next side, you can see how these circles, which represent the S, I'm sorry, I didn't say this, the S represents how one perceives self, and the O represents how one perceives the other. So in more successful psychological development, the self is eventually perceived as a complex being with positive and negative characteristics, and you kind of let it all be and accept it all for its richness. And similarly with others, you get to realize that other people aren't perfect, but nor are they horrible, except for people who are horrible. But, you know, those are the odd persons, like, who tend to be sociopaths. We're not talking about them. There might be saintly people, too. But most people are generally a mix of good and bad characteristics. And hopefully, in the course of development, we get to the stage of what's called good enough. Instead of sort of hoping for perfection, if you find yourself good enough, you accept yourself as such, and similarly for the other people in your life. Now, in the following slide, you'll see a New Yorker cartoon that explains TFP better than I will. It plays on this good cop, bad cop distinction, and you see a man who's a policeman or detective interviewing a guy who looks like a criminal saying, "I'm neither a good cop nor a bad cop, Jerome. Like yourself, I'm a complex amalgam of positive and negative personality traits that emerge or not depending on the circumstances." We try to bring our patients to that more complex appreciation of self and other. Now, going on to the next slide, and then I'm going to jump back to those little graphics. The evolution of treatment is from splitting, that slide where the two halves of the mind were one all positive and one all negative, is what we call the split organization. We try to bring people from that to a more integrated organization. Now, I introduce in this slide called the evolution of treatment certain terms I want to explain. I talk about going from the projection of negative motivations to the capacity to take responsibility for one's thoughts, feelings, actions, even if they're very negative, and integrate them. In older psychoanalytic terms, we call this moving from the paranoid schizoid position to the depressive position. I want to explain those terms because on the one hand, they might seem a little old-fashioned, but they make sense. If you go up to the slide called split organization, which is slide 8, what happens, according to our clinical experience, is that often people who have this split in their mind between the all good side and the all bad side tend to project or see in others a lot of the negative stuff that is hard to own up to in oneself. So in that sense, the mind is, we call it the schizoid position because it's split, and we call it the paranoid position because a lot of negative emotion is not consciously experienced as part of the self, but it is seen as in others. And therefore, there's a basic mistrust of others as perhaps being dangerous. And we see this all the time in our patients, where just when there begins to be something positive developing in the therapy, the patient might get more anxious to say, "I'm nervous," because they don't quite believe in the goodwill of the other person because of this projection of negative emotions that we find takes place in a lot of people. So if you then move on to the next slide called normal organization, consciousness of integration and complexity, that follower of Freud, Melanie Klein, somewhat oddly called this the depressive position, so I always have to explain in a talk like this that we put a great deal of effort into helping people arrive at the depressive position, and people always say, why on earth would you want that to be a goal? By the way, it's not the end point, because there are problems in the depressive position that can also be worked on. But this is called the depressive position because of two things. First of all, if you look back at the split organization, there's something in that that's pretty desirable. And if I had you in front of me, I'd see if anybody wanted to raise their hand and tell me what that is. But it's the possibility of perfection. So somebody with a split organization, as disturbed and chaotic and turbulent as their life might be, they're holding out for something perfect. In this sense, I find that a lot of borderline people I know or patients I've had are kind of failed romantics. If you think of romanticism like in the 19th century sense of the romantic movement, looking for something perfect in the world. They're looking for something perfect, but it always gets messed up on the way. And then the anger and depression come in. So if you move beyond the split organization, you have to kind of give up that you're going to find the perfect person. And there's a mourning associated with that. You have to give up your wish for perfection. Now, in our way of thinking about the mind and about life, you can sublimate that. You can find perfection in art or religion or the pursuit of something, but you're not going to find it in your friend or your spouse. Unless I'm missing something. But in any case, so that's a process that takes some time and psychological work. But the other reason the more integrated state is called the depressive position is that somebody who tended unconsciously and just automatically to project onto others the angry, negative emotion side of themselves, as they begin to acknowledge that and integrate that, they have some remorse for things they've done. Just a simple example, a patient of mine who at one point early in the therapy, I got a call from her husband saying, what do I do, doc? My wife just picked up the TV and threw it across the room at me. Now, when I spoke to the patient, she said, well, of course I did that because I forget what he'd done, but something was, you know, hurtful. And she didn't see any anger or aggression. She thought her throwing the TV at him was just like a sort of basic response to her anger and disappointment, and that it was sort of justified. So later on, when she began to see her own angry part, she said, gosh, I really feel bad about some of the stuff I did to my husband, also some things I did to you, because there were some moments in the therapy that were pretty intense. But that's what we hope for, because that's where we can work with it in the therapy setting. I'm going to move on in just a second because we have about 9 more slides. But I did want to say, if you think about this progression from the split organization to the integrated organization, I think you can see how there's a continuum between anyone with BPD and anyone who may seem to have moved beyond BPD. Because I would argue that there's a split core in all of us, that we really have a nostalgia and a longing for a world where everything is simple in terms of good and bad. You know what's right. You know what's wrong. There's no ambiguity. You don't have that confusing complexity. And for evidence of this, I would argue that people enjoy nothing more in the Northeast than going to a Red Sox-Yankees game. Whatever side you're on, you know you're right and the other is totally wrong. And the most successful blockbuster movies are all about the good and the bad. We like to, for a couple of hours, escape from the complexity of the world and go back to a more simple organization. In terms of entertainment, it's fine. I think it gets dangerous, and here I'm taking a two-second detour from individual problems to societal problems when groups think this way. I would argue that any fundamentalist group, whether it's a Christian fundamentalist group or an Islamic fundamentalist group or any kind of fundamentalist group, has this split organization, which is very dangerous because they think that only they know the truth and the good and the bad is outside them, and that would justify violence. Let's let's get back to the individual situation. Okay, we've discussed the slide evolution of treatment. Now, let's get to what transference is, since we call our work transference-focused psychotherapy, and I don't think I've defined the term. Before I get to what's on this slide, just simply, transference is the transfer of material from within the mind to people and situations in the outside world. It's sort of a transfer from internal to external. Put in more slightly technical terms, it's the activation of internal object relations, those images of self and other, activation of these in the relationship with the therapist. It can happen in relations outside the therapy, of course. It can happen all the time. And by the way, I think we all transfer. When I meet somebody for the first time, if they remind me of somebody I've known in the past, I make assumptions that may not be justified. And my task then is to get enough data from the person, the new person I'm meeting, to see how accurate my transference image is or how much I have to revise that to fully appreciate the new person. So we all transfer. I'm sorry, I'm here in New York and there's always sirens. So an interesting concept that Otto Kernberg described, one of his more simple statements, but one that took me a while to figure out, is the next point. An affect is the manifestation of an underlying imagined, it should be, relationship. And there's a beautiful example I saw of Dr. Kernberg working with a patient who came into this session looking just thoroughly depressed, looked neurovegetatively depressed, no energy, slow and talking, monotone, just saying he's depressed, there was no reason to live. And most of us would have just written for Prozac. But Dr. Kernberg, believing that underneath most emotions is an imagined relation between self and other, started asking questions, trying to get more specifics, and it turned out that the patient was experiencing the therapist and others in general as harshly critical, and that was a projection of an image in his mind that he was always berating himself. And when all this was clarified, he was able to move somewhat beyond the level of depression. Of course, it took longer to work things out fully in the therapy. But beneath what looked like a simple depressive affect was an imagined relationship of self constantly being criticized with no hope to ever move beyond that. So we feel that when we work with transference, we're working with object relations, these imagined relationships that are stocked in our mind, that are activated in the immediate moment. And this creates a therapy that is what we call experience near, that we're talking about and feeling about the basic problems as they're happening. So when you have the affect and the opportunity to reflect on it present simultaneously, that's when we think you make the most progress. So how do we do this? We set up conditions where the patient comes and then begins to experience the relationship with us as the work proceeds. And this is another reason we keep that neutral position, because we want to see what the person makes of us. And it's quite remarkable how things, let me put it this way, again, I don't want to give the impression we're just sitting there like inanimate objects. I want to just tell you the experience way back at the beginning of my practice that convinced me of some of the validity of this method. My first patient in practice after I finished my training was a man in his mid-30s who was a pretty angry guy with narcissistic and borderline personality, and he kind of put off most people with his anger and hostility and passive aggression, sometimes active aggression. And, of course, he was pretty depressed, lonely, and isolated. In any case, at one point in one of the sessions in the first few months, he was telling me a story about his growing up that was so sad that, in a way that was quite unusual, it brought tears to my eyes, which I don't usually do in sessions. Of course, he noticed that. He looked at me and said, "You have tears in your eyes." And, of course, I said, "Yes." And I was curious about how he would respond. He looked at me very carefully, like scrutinizing me. And then he said, "You're mocking me." And I could have never at that point imagined that interpretation of that external evidence. And that's when I saw that you have to see what somebody makes of the situation in the moment to see where they're really coming from, if you will. So we want people to experience us as they experience others. We want to tease out these internal relationships. We want to help people gain and tolerate awareness of these relationships and the related affects. And then we want to try to bring it together as a whole and generalize it to their experience outside of therapy. Now, I think we can finish the slides and still have 10 minutes for discussion. So moving on, there's another graphic here. This is a very schematic, simplistic view of the internal world of a patient with BPD. The idea is that there are these different dyads or relationship models or paradigms that are totally separate from one another. Some of them have a very positive affective emotional charge and some of them very negative. And depending on the trigger, there is an activation of both the affect and the representation associated with the affect. So we want to understand both the affect and the representation. So I'm going to move on to, well, let me just give you an example of how different triggers can shift a person very abruptly from one of these dyads to another with no continuity. Back in the days when we had long-term hospitalizations, I was working with a patient who had been in the hospital many months, and we were beginning to discuss her discharge, which would be another few weeks, which doesn't exist hardly at all these days anymore. And she entered a session saying, you know, you're the best therapist I've ever had. I had these 8 or 10 therapists before coming to the hospital. None of them knew what they were doing, which might have sounded great to me, but it sounded like idealization and a little, you know, beyond an accurate perception of things. In any case, she went on in this idealizing mode for a while and then said, you know, because you've helped me so much, I wonder if you would be my therapist after discharge. Now, that's a perfectly valid question, but it's a question that entails a number of considerations. So I said, well, you know, that's an important question to discuss. We have to think about, you know, different things related to that question. And on a dime, she changed and said, you know, I don't even know why I come here. I've never learned a thing from you. You're a total waste of time. You know, you're the worst therapist I've ever had. She slammed the door, went down to the unit, gathered all the patients together to tell them what a bad therapist I was. Now, it's this awful discontinuity that can be so disruptive in a person's life. And here I would argue that the trigger event was my not immediately saying, yes, I'll be your therapist. That would have been reassuring, but, you know, I had to check out certain things first, look into certain practical considerations. So when I didn't say yes, even though I didn't say no, the patient seemed to hear me as saying no, and thus flipped from a dyad where she was with a positive, totally positive other to a dyad with a totally negative other, and her response corresponded. So let's go to the next slide where we have two yellow boxes, and the slide is called Why Focus on Transference. These two boxes actually all together represent the mind of the patient, but the yellow box to the right is the therapist as perceived by the patient. The therapist actually is in two positions in relation to the patient. The therapist is there to allow these projections, these unfoldings of internal representations to kind of flood over him or her. But the therapist also hovers above the interaction, observing it, trying to understand it, and trying to engage the patient to understand it. So to give you another example from practice, I was working with a woman who'd been hospitalized for a suicide attempt and whose position at the beginning of therapy was that she didn't have any psychiatric diagnosis. She had made a suicide attempt because her husband was just a very mean and relentlessly negative person in her life. And for all I knew, that was the case. Can be the case in certain people's lives. It is the case. So one of the advantages we find of working with the transference is you can kind of tell more with time what's part of the internal world and what's part of the external reality. So with this patient, we met for maybe 3 months, I don't recall exactly, and one day I was 3 minutes late for a session, and I'm sort of obsessional, so I'm pretty sure it was just 3 minutes. Walked into the waiting room. I was up to that point always there before the patient. She had arrived, sat down, and as I walked in 3 minutes after the session was to begin, she was running out of the waiting room toward the parking lot. I ran after her saying, wait, we've got a session. Why don't you come back? But she got into her car and went away. So at that point, I went to my office, waited till I thought she'd have time to go to her home. I called up and asked, why'd you leave? And she said, quote, now I have proof of what I always suspected, but now I have proof. I said, well, what's that? She said, quote, now I know for sure you hate me and you don't want me to be your patient. Now, I would consider that transference because that wasn't at all how I felt. But the, you know, the trigger of my not being there on time was perceived as my disinterest. And it activated images in her of a person totally uninterested and rejecting of another. So here we're in a dilemma because even though I don't see the reality the same way, she's very much into that view of reality. So I said, you know, I think it would be important to come to the next session to discuss this. I didn't, by the way, try to reason her out of her belief. I didn't say, let's be reasonable. You know, people can be a few minutes late. It really doesn't mean one person hates the other because I don't think that kind of reasoning helps. So I let the projection exist. I said, you know, I didn't know you felt that way. I'd like to know more about that. Why don't you come to the next session? We can discuss it. She said, why would I come to a session with a therapist who hates me and doesn't want me there? She was very into that. That internal representation, I would say, had flooded her reality for the moment. So I had to think on my feet, and I said, well, that makes sense. I understand that. But on the other hand, if I really didn't want you to be my patient, why would I be calling you and encouraging you to come to the next session? She said, I don't know, that doesn't make sense. And I said, well, that's when therapy can help when things don't make sense. So she did come to the next session, and we could work with this projection, and we could work with other projections, and we could try eventually to put them together. So the reason, by the way, in this slide, that if you look down at the third dyad, the S303, there the object representation is partly back into the experience of the self, because at that point, the patient is beginning to see that the way she sees and experiences others may be, have to do with emotions she has in herself that she doesn't consciously process so well but might act out. So, moving on, we have a few slides. Yeah, only four slides. I'm just going to describe a couple of different ways these relationship paradigms can interact that we can use therapeutically. First is what we call oscillation. So here we take for this slide the classic victim-persecutor experience, which is patient feels a victim of somebody else is being mean to them. And what we find often is that within the same relationship paradigm, there's a flipping of the roles that happens in action but not in conscious awareness. So here I use the example of the patient who was a student of therapy as she was beginning her therapy with me, and after a few months, as she walked into the office, glanced at my bookshelf and said, I'd really like to read that book, you know, very important for my studies, will you lend it to me? And if I'd just been a friend or, you know, a member of the family, I would have said sure, but as a therapist, I'm always curious about things, especially things that seem different, and this was the first time she'd asked me for anything. So I said, oh, well, that's interesting, you haven't asked me for anything before. I wonder if there's anything going on that we should think about. I thought maybe she's getting a different image or feeling more positive in the relationship. But again, even though I didn't say no, it was experience that trigger sentence, you know, why don't we just think about this? That's interesting. You're asking me for something. The patient took that as a no, and she immediately jumped out of her chair that she just sat down in, started pacing back and forth, angrily shaking can of Coke that she had, looking like she was going to throw at me, and started yelling at me, saying I was a horrible person, I would wouldn't stop if she were dying in the street. I'd walk right over her. She was cursing and saying things I don't want to say on the phone conversation since it's being recorded. But anyway, I was a real son of a bitch, to put it mildly. So that's one of those moments of heightened emotional intensity in therapy that we hope we can use therapeutically. So after a few minutes, I'm thinking, okay, what's going on? I said, this, I think, is an oscillation of the dyad. She's saying I'm treating her badly, but, you know, at least for the moment, she's treating me pretty badly. Can I get her to see that? So I said, you know, I had thought if she was interested, and she sort of expressed enough interest, I thought I'd share the thought. And I said, you know, if you were walking by the office window there looking in, what would you see? And at that point, she did say, well, I guess you'd see me being pretty nasty to you. And I said, well, yeah, you might. And there's no problem with that. Everybody can be angry and everybody can express negative feelings. The problem is it's far better if you're aware of it and thus in control, because I think you were doing it without being so aware. So instead of controlling the emotion was controlling you. If you want to be angry, if you think I'm a, you know, son of a bitch and want to tell me that, you can do that anytime you want. But, you know, if you sort of think it through, you choose the way to do it and the words to do it, it might be better. So that's an example of trying to help somebody integrate something they act out but don't have a fully conscious grasp of. Moving on to the next slide, this is what we call one-object relation defending against the other. And this gets back to that basic split between a negative side of the internal world and a totally idyllic and ideal side. And we find that in our patients, the real split isn't between the victim and persecutor, which is often a misunderstanding. People say, oh, well, the victim is good and the persecutor is bad, but I don't think there's much good in being a victim. The real split is between a negative relationship with an other or others and an ideal one. And without giving the time, I'll just say that as therapy progresses, we usually find evidence for both of these relationship models in the material. Most classically, people come in a more angry, negative state, and then you see hints and suggestions that they have a possible way of experiencing the relationship that would be totally the opposite, but they're afraid to show. And you can bring that to light, and then you can show them how this is totally negative and the totally positive, and what is it that makes it so, that makes their life such that they're totally in one or totally in the other? What is it that makes it hard to bring these things together? So, moving on, our basic techniques, as I said at the beginning, and here I'm beginning to summarize, is setting up a treatment frame, conditions of treatment, and keeping it going. Because it's only in a stable frame that two things happen. One is you calm down what's often the chaos enough to sort of be able to observe and think about things. And two, it kind of channels affects into the session. Then we use the interpretive process. We clarify internal states. I think you've heard about mentalization from Lois Choi Kang. And we find a lot of overlap between our early stage of clarifying internal states and what the mentalization people do, which is very valuable. Then we look at contradictions between different states, things that don't add up, this discontinuity where things are very, like the patient who started out idealizing me and left so angry and rageful, the next session, the confrontation or the contradiction was simply, how can we understand that at the beginning of the last session you felt so totally one way and at the end the other way? We try to get people to reflect on that. And then we try to interpret why these extremes continue to exist in the person's mind. And finally, last slide, what changes? We think that clinical improvement, by which we mean both symptoms, you know, acting out, depression, anxiety, but also engagement in life and feeling comfortable in relations, we feel that clinical improvement results from what we call structural change. That might be an abstract term, but what I mean is change in the structure of the mind from that split picture to the integrated picture. We try to do this by first having a holding function of the therapist. That frame of therapy, the conditions of therapy and the attitude of the therapist create the feeling that it's okay to feel things really intensely there. As they're felt, we observe them and interpret them with the patient, and we think by this we can help decrease that terrible split between one extreme and the other, lead to some coherence in the identity, and thus smoother functioning in life. So, there you go, Perry. We have 10 minutes for questions.
Oh, well, this is wonderful, Frank. Thank you so much. And I'll start off just by a comment that came, and I think it sums it up well. Another stellar presentation by Dr. Yeomans. I thoroughly enjoyed listening to his explanations, accented by the examples he shared. Regards from a former patient who is doing well and forever wishes him the best.
Oh, it's so wonderful.
Right. So that, and I think that all of us on the call could say that to you. So there are really some wonderful questions that have come in, and I'm really trying to make decisions. Well, so let's start with, what, if any, is the significance of object relations therapy theory in TFP versus attachment theory in MBT, which is mentalization, and how are the two treatment modalities distinct as both focus on transference in a therapeutic setting?
Great question, and sort of a multiple question. First of all, let me say, I think that TFP and MBT overlap a lot. I've worked for almost 30 years with Kernberg and his group now, but I know Fonig and his group, and I think there should be more cooperation and mutual sort of working together. That's what I think we should be heading towards. Object relations in mentalization, that was the first part of the question. Mentalization stems from that part of psychoanalytic tradition called attachment theory, which has a different focus but is not unrelated to object relations theory. But attachment theory focuses on the particular attachment system within the mind, which is one of a number of systems. There's also other systems like, you know, the sexual system, aggressive systems. I'm not being totally articulate about this now, but I would say that TFP, while considering the attachment system as extremely important, pays a little more attention to some of the other mental psychological systems. And to go beyond that, I would say that while mentalization focuses on the idea that gaining the ability to be in touch with one's inner state and with the inner state of the other resolves problems, we feel that there's an added step which mentalization doesn't do as much, which is the interpretation of conflicts. If you want to get to specifics, mentalization sees a lot of the patient's anger and angry and acting out behavior as a response to what they call the alien self, which is the internal representation of a traumatizing object. And that as mentalization improves and the person realizes that most people and themselves are generally more benign and don't have that traumatizing element, then there is a resolution of the impact of that alien self traumatizing us. Here's the main difference. In TFP, we think that every person's mind has aggressive drives as well as loving libidinal drives, and that this was necessary for the survival of the species during evolution, and that it's not a bad thing because all aggression isn't bad. You can use your aggressive drives for ambition, for competition, for creativity. So rather than seeing the aggressive part of the mind as this alien self that just dissolves when understanding is achieved, we feel it's a component that has to be integrated. Were there other elements to that question, Perry?
No, I think that was it. I'll give you some more.
Okay.
Okay, can dyads be thought of as sort of a schema? Is this relevant?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because Jeffrey Young knows about object relations theory and sees the schemas as very closely related to what we call the dyads, and I see a relationship too. The difference, as I understand it, is that schema therapy sees the schemas as more concrete than we would see the dyads. From different discussions I've had with Jeffrey, he tends to focus more on the role of a negative early environment on the patient. He thinks that the internalization of the negative representations of others is more historically factual, whereas we presentations is modified by all the psychological processes going on, the sort of fantasy levels of the mind. So we often find exaggerations in the dyad representations, where I think the schema therapy sees them as a little bit more concrete and literal. Okay?
Okay. How can families utilize TFP in providing a supportive foundation for their family members? Are there any training programs geared specifically for family members?
Not at this point, although one of our group, Peter Fried, just in the past few months has repeatedly, well, he's actually taken the initiative to start more coordinated involvement of families in treatment. But I must precede this by saying we do not take the old stereotype view of psychoanalysts that, you know, there's no contact except with the patient. We understand there needs to be communication with families in many cases, not in all cases. But my most usual approach is to have a, you know, assessment, a couple of sessions with the patient, and then a discussion about my impressions, my treatment recommendations, and then if there are parents or a partner or spouse very closely involved, to have those people or that person join in so there's a mutual understanding from the beginning. Then as the therapy proceeds, I say, look, I can't say anything that the patient says to me except if it's, you know, life-threatening, but if you folks want to give me some information you think is relevant, that's okay. So, you know, we find it is helpful to have that network, so to speak. So what Peter is suggesting is that we have a more formal arrangement because it often is useful for families to have some contact with a colleague of ours who understands this treatment model and can work a little bit in parallel with the family. And, how can a family use the TFP construct? I think through an understanding of projection, if you understand that what you are being treated as is probably an exaggeration. Let me put it this way. If somebody is yelling at me and telling me I've treated them horribly, it's just my natural instinct to think that must be the case, and perhaps occasionally it is. But if you say, okay, I know what projection is. I know this is an exaggeration. If I look at what the trigger was and I try to see how we got from the trigger to this exaggerated thing, it helps me maintain my peace of mind without getting so caught up in the moment.
Who was Peter? Did you say someone named Peter?
Peter Fried, yeah. You don't know him, Barry. He's a relatively new member of our group, but he's been with us for a number of years. He's a very bright young guy, and it's always great to have new blood in the group.
Okay, very interesting. A few more things, and this sort of segues into that you're coming back, and someone said, well, how smart were we to ask you to come back already because you were just terrific. This person said, I've seen several couples in which the wife has BPD and the husband has narcissism.
Oh.
Have you seen this often, and if so, is there a natural attraction between these two, and how do you handle the treatment of this person with BPD, especially if the husband is often not in treatment?
Let me start by saying I more often see couples where one party has more borderline and histrionic characteristics and the other party is more obsessional, more than the narcissist. Let me comment about that, then I'll get to the narcissist.
Yeah.
Because obsessional people tend to suppress and clamp down their emotions. I think they have an attraction to people who are like in really intense contact with their emotions. I want to use this as a segue back to saying about the continuum between BPD and the rest of the population. If you look at great works of literature, any number of them have people with BPD as the main character. I would argue that Scarlett O'Hara has a lot of borderline traits, and who is a better-known heroine in American literature and film? But she has this intensity of feeling that most people can only feel in fantasy, So I think obsessional people sort of want somebody to feel things for them vicariously, if you will, and that can happen through a spouse or through literature. There can, however, be the borderline narcissistic couple, and that's a big problem because narcissists are usually very oblivious to their role in the problem. So if you have that combination, the best you can do is, first of all, try to help the person you have in front of you in therapy understand some of the limitations that they may be dealing with in reality. If the other person's narcissistic, that means by definition they don't have too deep a capacity for empathy. Couples therapy can often help for those individuals, and ideally directing them to a therapy of their own. Were there any other parts to that question?
No, that was it. I'm going to also forward to you an email that came in saying I thought you would like to hear a TFP success story, so I will forward that to you individually. But it's very nice to just skim it and see the success that this person made and now is as a therapist herself. So what's better? Isn't that wonderful? Two other things, Frank. People are asking where they might find TFP and also where are therapists trained for TFP?
Okay, well, that's, yeah. Finding people, you could go to the Borderline Personality Disorder Resource Center up at the Westchester. I mean, you don't have to go physically, but you contact Winnie Christ, who is our coordinator there. She actually has this wonderful service. It's on the first slide, bpdresourcecenter.org. A wonderful family donated money trying to get together treatment resources for any kind of treatment that could help borderline individuals. And it's the best data bank that I'm aware of for resources in this country for TFP, DBT, mentalization, schema, steps, what have you, and also in other parts of the world. But if you are local and need a referral, you could call me, or, yeah, I'll give you my phone number, 212-213-3677. What we're doing in terms of educating is it's just sort of a very accelerating pace that we're educating people because we've gotten a lot of interest from many different parts of the world. The irony is we're training more people in Europe than in this country. I have my own theories about the European mind versus the American mind, the American being more pragmatic and the European perhaps being a little more theory-oriented. But let's assume most of the people listening in are not from Europe. We're training people here in New York. Eve Callagore and I are doing a one-year training now. We do online training so that people can, you know, get trained from other parts of the country or the world. Barry Stern is doing some training in Pittsburgh. We've trained up some people in Boston. We're working with some people in California. And we have people just developing in other regions. But I would say that so far it's mostly limited to major metropolitan areas. So if you have any interest, you know, let me know or call Winnie Christ. But I am pleased to say that the demand for teaching is such that I could just spend all my time these days teaching, and yet I am so committed to my practice and get so much from that, I try to keep it a mix.
Frank, do you want to give your website, too, so people can get more information?
Okay. Again, it's on, you know, look. But as you say that, Barry, I'm embarrassed because we haven't updated it in a few months.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But it's good because I should. But we have two websites. The one for our Cornell group, which is the Personality Disorders Institute, is there on the first page of the slides, borderline disorders, with an S, disorders.com. And then we also have for our group in Manhattan, it's the psinstitute.org. So both those are up there on the title page of the talk.
Okay, thank you. There are other questions too, Frank. If you want, I can pass them on to you, and if you'd like to answer them at your leisure, we'll try to get them posted. We have others from other weeks that we're still hoping to get up, but we'd love to maybe you join that question and answer dialogue if that's okay with you.
I'll do my best.
We won't burden you. We'll try not to,
okay,
at least.
With the holidays coming, a couple of deadlines, I'll do that. in between things, and I'll do that to the best of my capacity, but I'm so glad there's interest.
Okay, yes, and I just want to let people know that next week we have Dr. Jim Breeling from the National Institute of Mental Health who will be talking about research, and also want to put in a last request for this week for people to send donations. All of this, Frank, of course, and all of our speakers have donated their time, but it does take money to get these recordings posted and our website and our family connections and all the other things we're trying to do. So your donations to us mean a lot, and it's a way of helping us to continue to help you. So thank you again, Frank. We look forward to having you back, and I'm glad we signed you up before we even got you going today so people would know they'd hear you again.
Okay.
So
thank you, Perry. It's a real opportunity, and the outreach you do is fantastic, so keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, and everybody good night, and we'll see you next Sunday. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.